Welcome back to Open Mind. I'm Keith Barry, and today we're diving into the mind of Fiona Brennan. Now, Fiona is a clinical hypnotherapist, which is far different than the stage performers that you see like me, so we'll talk about that in a moment. A best-selling author, founder of The Positive Habit, she's dedicated to helping people transform anxiety and negative thinking into confidence, calm, and lasting resilience. Fiona, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Keith. So happy to be here.
It's great to have you, and I'm familiar with your work, but let's start with clinical hypnotherapist, because I want people out there to know the distinction, I suppose, between stage hypnosis and a hypnotist versus a clinical hypnotherapist. There is a difference. I'm a hypnotist and a hypnotherapist, which causes some confusion. So from your own perspective, maybe in your own words, just explain what the difference is.
Well, if we start with the similarities.
Yeah.
I think that's helpful. In essence, they both demonstrate to any one individual the power of their own mind. Mm. And that's something that I feel so many people don't actually truly realize. And when they do, it's life changing. So what you do in your stage shows is amazing and incredibly awe-dropping for so many, if that's a word, awe-dropping, draw-dropping. It could be a word, it's a good one.
Yeah, I like it, awe-dropping. Yeah. I'll start to use that now.
Yeah, and I feel that really demonstrated so clearly like what we can do when we allow our imagination, let's say.
Yes.
And we tap into the subconscious and we see the power. So there is that element of it, of what they have in common. And then I suppose the other side of it is that I work quite deeply with people.
Yep.
In terms of the clinical component, in terms of really going quite deep of what are the layers to this? You know, if someone has anxiety, and that's something that I really understand professionally and personally, is okay. Something I've struggled with myself.
Yep.
In my younger years. It's something I always have to, I suppose, keep on top of, if you like, because it can so easily take its grip.
Yep.
Fear is something that when it presents itself can completely dominate if it's fertile soil, if you like, if the mind is not resourced enough to cope. So in terms of clinical hypnotherapy, you know, my biggest, like, I'm such an advocate, and what I've worked so hard to get across to my clients, to any opportunity I have like this to talk about it, is that it isn't a magic wand when it comes, like hypnosis, the hypnosis that I do, if you like, isn't this immediate, you know, I can't fix anxiety in one session. You know, that's just, I feel slightly unethical sometimes to promise that when I know in my heart I can't deliver that. So I like to work with people, you know, in using different modalities. And I suppose over the years, like, I'm doing this one-to-one for 13 years, and you start to see patterns. I'm sure you know yourself, Keith. You see these amazing patterns in people who feel that they're so alone. They think, this is just me. I'm the only person who feels so self-conscious, so not good enough, these deep-rooted negative beliefs. And you see them present again and again in very different people. And essentially, you know, what I want to do is, using hypnosis, using the power of imagination, essentially, like, I help them to unblock things and essentially begin to really value and appreciate who they are just as they are. And I really feel that, you know, I'm not the expert. And I'll always say that to a client. I'm not the expert here. You are.
Yeah.
It's my job to help you uncover everything that's already there.
Well, I like to say we're pattern followers and pattern seekers. And we're all far more alike than we are different. We all follow these patterns. And in order to be more productive, be more positive, you have to learn how to break those negative loops, those negative patterns that we get caught in, and form new, more positive behavior patterns. The big problem is, as you know, and as I know, the majority of these problems, these issues, they do lie subconsciously. And, you know, we could talk for hours, me and you, about the subconscious mind, what it is, what it entails. But I think on a pure kind of basic level for people out there, I mean, your subconscious mind regulates your autonomic nervous system, which is your heart rate, your blood flow, your breathing. that's where your anxieties lie, because when people describe anxiety to you, I'm sure it's the same with me. Some people feel a tightening of the chest. Other people feel like a dark cloud coming into their brain. And all of this is your autonomic nervous system getting whacked out of kilter by your thoughts. What's the biggest misconception when somebody comes to you for treatment, for a session? Like, what are some of the things that you might hear that people might be, are people skeptical of you, I suppose? They're skeptical of me. Are they skeptical of you sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. And quite often, you know, especially earlier in my career, I was the last sort of desperate place that they went to because they were struggling and suffering so much. So the biggest misconception is that the answer lies in me, I would say, that they're broken, that I'm going to fix them. And gradually, you know, I help them to see that that's just not the case.
Yep.
And I think that the most important thing, no matter what technique or tool you're using, is the relationship, like in any therapy. It's can you feel at ease and comfortable with me?
But I think this is really important because I need to pick up on that.
Yeah.
Simply because I hear it so many times, people who are desperate and people who say to me, I've tried everything and I've tried hypnosis and it didn't work.
Yeah.
No, it's not the technique of hypnosis that didn't work. You didn't find the right relationship with the right person. Yeah. I think it's so important for people to realize out there, you need to find a hypnotherapist, A, that you trust, B, that you can just connect with on a human level. Mm. It's not this Svengali thing where we're used to seeing in the movies, right? Where, you know, I'm an empowering individual and I'm going to dominate you.
Yeah.
And very often people think they're going to be in this crazy, weird, bizarre, altered state of mind. Yes, your brainwave states will slow down. Yes, you will be in somewhat of an altered state of mind, but you're still fully aware of your surroundings. You're fully aware of, you know, where you are and who you're there with. But I think it's very important to pick up on what you said, that it is that relationship and that bond. And I always say to people, like, if Fiona doesn't work for you, like, go to somebody else. But equally, if I don't work for you, don't rely on just the fact that I didn't work for you. Like, always try somebody else. And the most important thing is to find somebody who comes recommended and, you know, check their qualifications and check, you know, their reviews, and then give it a go. And if that person doesn't work for you, also I also say this, Fiona, sometimes, is that just because you weren't hypnotizable on one day doesn't mean you're not hypnotizable the next day. And that's important as well, because dependent on your sleep patterns, dependent on, you know, whether you've had an argument at work, that can all affect your focus point and whether or not you'll be in a frame of mind to work with you or I or another hypnotist.
Exactly.
So I think it's just important for people to realize that the relationship is key. Exactly,
yes,
what you said.
Exactly. And you're very unlikely, like if we're talking about it as a relaxation, a focused awareness, you know, what I love about hypnosis, hypnotherapy is that it's the most honest placebo you'll ever get.
Yeah.
You're not pretending anything.
Mm.
And that's what I love. And when people say, like, you know, that's a really good phrase, like, it didn't work. It's like, what is it?
Yeah. Right?
It is your amazing mind. And all it, your mind, needs is to feel safe and to feel relaxed.
Yeah.
And to be able to slowly start to shift. I mean, in terms of blocks, one that I see time and time again, whether it's one-to-one, whether it's on a retreat, group work, anywhere, it is impatience. My goodness.
Yeah, we're in that world now, aren't we? They want the instant fix. Everyone wants the instant fix.
Keith, honestly, you've no idea. Like, I came back from, I spent 3 months in Crete this summer.
Mm.
And it's a little bit like the emperor's new clothes. Like, you know, I suppose as we mature anyway, we start to see things differently. And, you know, essentially, my father died nearly a year ago. And there's a huge perspective shift that is becoming more and more profound with each and every day that passes, the awareness. And, you know, whenever I come back from Greece, I do notice, of course, the pace of life, etc. But this year, this time, it's a different year. And I know that you two have, like, we have that in common, that you lost your father.
Yeah, lost my dad this year. Yeah, January this year. Yeah.
And I was November. So we're very close in terms of, of that huge, I suppose, you could call it an experience in some sense, that it is an experience that you don't really know unless you've gone through it.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, just to share real quick for me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I've grieved yet or not. And maybe I'm grieving really well. Maybe I haven't grieved at all. Like, I had two really good cries. Now, I'm talking about cries like I've never had before. Like, literally never had. I'm not a crier, right? I'm not normally a crier. I'll cry at E.T. Every time E.T. dies, I'll cry. That's pretty much it, you know?
Yes.
Like, I didn't cry when my kids were born, like, even with joy. Mm. And that doesn't mean I'm not in touch with my emotions. I'm very aware of my emotions. But I'm just not a crier. Naturally, I'm just not a crier. So I had two really good cries. And I was thinking, well, obviously that's grief. But then I don't feel terrible that my dad is gone. And I think part of that is he had a long illness. And then also... had a great relationship with him. So like he said to me the last few days before he was dying, he was like, have you anything, because he couldn't really talk, he's like, have you anything to ask me? And I was like, no. And there's kind of a beauty in that. I didn't have anything to ask him. I didn't have anything to tell him either. Like, we were done and he was done, and it was kind of time for him to tap out. It doesn't mean I'm not sad that he's gone, of course I am, but I'm at peace with it. But again, I still question, have I grieved? Maybe I haven't grieved. And it's that weird thing, isn't it?
Without going too much into being the therapist here, but I would say that the fact that you're asking that question is means something, right?
Yeah,
because, essentially, like, you know, I really feel, Keith, like from the bottom of my heart, that society now doesn't, there isn't the time to grieve, right?
That's so true, yeah.
So we have to take it. We have to make it.
Yeah.
And I've been very sort of aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, because when my dad's was maybe different in the sense, was a very short, sharp, traumatic, very traumatic death. And, you know, it was like a roller coaster in terms of everything was changing one day to the next.
Okay.
You know, he's coming home, palliative care, he's not, he's in hospital, he's going to the hospice. And it's just, it's moving so fast.
Yeah.
You can hardly keep up with it. And since he died, which is coming up to a year in November the 17th, I am aware that it's integral for us. And I've seen it so many times with clients who haven't grieved. Like, I will sit down and talk to someone and I'll say, so tell me about, you know, you never mentioned your mother in the forum.
Yeah.
I go, oh no, my mum died 6 years ago. And go, oh my goodness. I said, you know, I'm really sorry to hear.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. It was 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's coming.
Yeah.
Right? Something that has been literally frozen.
Yeah.
Because society doesn't give this, we're living in such a fast-paced place that, you know, there is the sadness around at the time, the funeral, and then it moves on and you can see it.
Yeah.
You can see it in people. Oh, yeah. Did your dad die? Oh, yeah. God, that was ages ago. So tell us now, what's the crack? And, you know, of course, there is the sense of life goes on, but it's different. It's different life.
Mm.
It's certainly personally more wonderful in many ways, because I do feel that my relationship with my father, and I, like you, was very, very, very close to him. Like a kind of rock, if you like, in my life. A very supportive father who always championed me and saw the best in me. And I think that's such a gift that you give to someone, to see the best in them. And he's actually the reason I became a clinical hypnotherapist.
I was about to ask you
about
that in a moment.
I'll tell you that.
But hang on, I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Did you use your own techniques on yourself when your dad passed? And if you did, can you share those techniques with our listeners? Because there's going to be people out there who've lost loved ones recently, maybe haven't grieved and need some tools and techniques. Well, what did you find worked for you?
Well, 1,000%, I used every skill that I have. And the way that I look at it is, it's like money in the bank. You have the resource and you can now spend it when you really need it. So it was the 3rd of October last year. I was walking down to meet some friends. It was their big birthday dinner. It was just like a Tuesday night, you know, but we were going out for dinner to celebrate. And I was walking past Howth, because I live on the coast on the south side. And I was walking past Howth looking across. And I thought of a friend who lives there. I thought, I'll just send him a little text, check in with him. Because my phone's always on silent, right? I just don't want it bothering me.
Yeah.
I took out my phone and my dad was calling me. So in other words, I would have missed that call had I not had this idea.
Right,
How things, I really believe in that sense of things are all happening for a reason. So my dad usually would talk to me after my mom. It's unusual that my dad would have actually rang me directly, you know, be like, mom would say, and your dad's here. And they were in Greece at the time. And he said to me, are you alone? I said, well, I'm actually walking out, Dad, by the coast here. Good, he said. is there a bench nearby you? I said, there is. There's a bench right there.
Yeah.
Sit on it, he said. So you can imagine your heart is starting to pound at a very, I'm sitting, Dad, I'm sitting. This morning, he said, I went for an MRI. He'd been in a lot of pain. And essentially, they didn't know at all what was going on. It was a physiotherapist who said, I recommend you go. There's something here I can't quite get to the bottom of. Mm-hmm. It could be something in the lungs. And in this little clinic in Greece, a young guy, a lovely young Greek guy, saw that my dad had stage 4 cancer in his lungs, his liver, his bones. And my dad, he's an amazingly perceptive man. He said, what do you see? And the guy was like, I don't know. You'll have to wait till the doctor. He goes, tell me.
Yeah.
I'm okay. You can tell me. Yeah. So this guy told him what he thought it was. And Greece, I can't believe the system was so fast. But within 2 hours, he had the results emailed to him. And they knew. So that was the same day.
Yeah.
So as soon as he told me, and this is why I'm sharing the techniques.
Yeah.
The first thing that I practice, and I always share with my clients, is to go immediately, no matter what's happening, no matter how hard it is, into acceptance. So I accepted it right there.
That's fascinating. It's one of my techniques. Same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right there and right then. I didn't go, oh God, no. Dad, please, no. I said, okay, Dad, thank you for sharing. I'm so sorry. I said, and it sounds kind of almost, not cruel, but I think you'll understand, Keith. I said, at least it's not me.
Yeah.
And at least it's not Luca.
Yeah.
Who's my son.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're going in the circle of life, right?
Yep.
In other words, the acceptance that I know, we all know our parents are going to die.
Yeah, this is the way life should be, or not should be, but the way life is.
If it's going well,
yeah,
then that's the
cycle. That's the progression.
Thank God. It's you, and I would hate for him to have had to see me or his grandson die. So I could feel that was healing for him, because immediately you're taking away the greatest fear that many people who are dying have, and that is that they're leaving their loved ones behind. But if you can actually practice and show that you have the strength and that you're going to be okay, well, then that gives such permission for that person to begin their exit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's a real, I suppose, strange beauty in it.
There is. Know? There is a strange beauty in it. And we kind of, the conversation came to an end somehow, some way. And there was a moment where I thought, this is so odd. Do I continue on to my dinner, or do I go home to my husband and son and share this heartbreaking news?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't quite sure what to do, right?
Yeah.
And then I just started to walk forward, and I went to the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go into it with my good friends. I just stayed. I said, I won't be staying long, I said.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the sense of being able to actually carry the pain. As I walked, the tears were falling down my face. Mm-hmm. But the skill there, and I suppose it's having that resource, I was breathing into my own pain.
I think it's interesting, right? So that I think people listening might think that you're about to give us some some crazy, deep, hypnotic, therapeutic technique. But instead, it was the learned technique of acceptance. And I think that comes from maybe being in the industry that you're in, maybe me being in the industry. But I remember years ago, I don't know how or why, but years ago, I learned the same technique. Like I've been in, people don't understand. Like first of all, I say my baggage is no different than yours, and it's no different than the listeners. We all just carry different baggages at different moments in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. But like I've been in car accidents where actually, for real, my foot was 5 minutes from amputation, right? Back in 2007, that was. But I remember immediately being in the car, looking down with my foot wrapped up around my shin, going the wrong way, all the bones like completely gone, knee was broken. And I remember just accepting it in the moment. Now, that sounds crazy to people listening out there, but it comes back to the one thing, I suppose, that we have that a lot of people don't have, which is the ability to mentally program. And then I say, once you accept, then you can immediately magnify the positive. So I suppose for you in that moment, as crazy and all as this might seem to people, your dad was still alive, right? So he hadn't dropped dead of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like my grandfather was killed in a botched burglary in 2009, I think it was. But I remember accepting that. And then, but how do you magnify the positive? And all I could magnify in that moment was like the amazing memories I had of him and his wife, Nancy, bringing us to the beach as kids with my cousins. So I just magnified the memories. So you can always magnify the positive in any scenario. But I think you're right. Acceptance is key, because the why me and the victim mentality just won't help.
Yeah, but I'd say you're skipping a step there in terms of magnifying the positive, right? Yes, that's obviously, like, you know, going into gratitude and the positive memories. It's so important. But it's the pain. I wasn't ignoring the pain.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's like the pain is real. The suffering is real. It's not to pretend it's not there.
Yeah.
It is there. You know, there is a loss, as much as there is, you know, the acceptance. It doesn't mean that there isn't the deep emotional pain. And I think that's the courage. It's the courage to feel those emotions and to know how to feel them. Like when I'm working with clients, I think that's what I see most, is the fear of these deep, painful emotions.
Yeah.
It's the fear of them rather than the emotion itself that causes people to suffer.
Yeah.
When you know how to actually go in and hold your own sadness, your own anger, your own irritation, your own frustration, your own, you know, maybe feelings of inadequacy or jealousy or any of these things that we all have, right? You liberate yourself because you're not afraid of what's inside of you.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the deepest kind of unfortunate thing is, that so many people are afraid essentially of their own, of themselves, of the emotions that they carry. And, you know, really, it goes to sort of deep inner child work as well, where you're holding the emotion like a baby. You know, I'm very influenced by the Zen Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who talks about that in terms of, you know, you kind of, if you hear a baby cry, you know, you pick them up, you hold them, you soothe them, and they'll stop crying eventually, you know, once they feel that love and that safety. And our emotions are like that. They're scared. They're lost. They're, you know, it's a huge thing. Like, there's a part of me that's like the little girl who's going, "Daddy, don't leave me. Don't leave me. I love you so much," you know. And it's the ability to go towards that little girl inside and go, "I'm here. I've got you. You can hold this pain." And and that's what I did. That was the 3rd of October, right up to the 17th of November, where it was a very fast and rapid deterioration. Yeah. He had to fly home from Greece in a really, you know, it was a miracle that he got home.
Yeah.
And each and every step of that way, I was working with myself. So when you say, you know, was I practicing the tools? I think that even tools or strategies or techniques, they do a disservice to what we're talking about here, because they're much more than that, aren't they? I mean, they're actually a whole shift in terms of your nervous system has changed.
Yeah, completely. And and interestingly, like after my dad passed, life just got kind of complicated. So I found one thing. Here's an interesting thing. I don't know if this ever happened to you. Like, I found that my techniques kind of weren't working for me, which was interesting. So like, I was doing my ice bath every day. I was doing my breath work every day. I was doing my, you know, self-hypnosis every day. And really, people listening, all hypnosis is actually self-hypnosis. You're just a guide and I'm just a guide. And people then enter into willingly themselves.
Yeah.
But I found I was struggling, that my techniques weren't really kind of working for me. So I had to kind of research and search again. And so I'll share this, right? It's kind of interesting. I've read a lot and I've researched a lot of different people, a lot of different things, but I don't know why at this particular moment of time, I was just attracted to Joe Dispenza's work. Now, interestingly, like people out there, they'll have to do their own research into Joe Dispenza. My opinion of Joe is that he overclaims what his techniques, what he and his techniques do. That's just an opinion, okay? However, with that prerequisite in place, I found that his techniques that I just found on YouTube. Now, I had other ones that I downloaded and paid for many years ago, so I had those on the laptop. But I found one or two on YouTube that really helped me. And you know, I don't know if it was because it was Joe or his, but whatever it was, it really helped me. And again, it goes back to, like, sometimes we struggle, and we even struggle with our own techniques or with techniques that we've learned from other people. But I always say to people, there's always hope. There's always hope with finding a solution for your pain, your anger, your frustration, whatever that is. And there's always a solution if you're willing to search deep enough and long enough for it, rather than giving up. So to loop back to it then, I want to find out, you said your dad was kind of inspirational with your hypnosis. How did it come about that you became a hypnotherapist? So we don't keep talking about the deaths of our fathers for the whole hour. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, But, yeah. So having said that, though, I do think it is important to highlight that people do, we need to take time to grieve, just to close on that. Like, I think it's very important. And that message is out there in a positive way. When I was 10 years old, my dad, he had a triple bypass. Okay. So we always thought it would be his heart and that would be what took him. But it wasn't in the end. But he was a smoker. He was quite a bon vivant. He was a poet. He was a great. He was kind of, he'd walk into the room and the whole place, he just had such charisma and a big booming, amazing voice, big man. And he smoked, as many, many people did, including myself back in the day. And he was struggling to give up, and he'd had a triple bypass, and he knew, like, the consultant was going, what? He was still smoking occasionally when he was out and stuff. Yeah. And he went to a guy, oh my goodness, now he was a surgeon in County Meath. You probably know who it is. But
Dr. Jack Gibson. Just as Ed said it, I was about to say Jack Gibson. It came to my head.
Yeah.
So listen, Jack Gibson, I have not investigated properly into this person because I know he was at the forefront of this way back in the day.
He was, and he did surgeries and everything on people. And essentially, my dad went to him for quit smoking.
Yeah.
And my bedroom was kind of like, it had been one big room, and my dad put a wall between the two. So his study was there and my bedroom was there. So I would hear, like, everything my dad talking to himself, typing, you know, the whole lot. And he would put on the hypnosis
CD back in the day.
A tape.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Tape. Tapes.
Before the CD days,
CDs were a thing of the modern world.
Yeah.
And I would hear this as I was going to sleep. You know, you don't smoke anymore. Smoking is just whatever.
Yeah.
And I was going, wow. And I remember thinking, like, those tapes are saving my daddy's life. Mm. That's what I thought. Because they worked.
Yeah.
And he was a big believer in it, you know, in terms of how it transformed his ability to stop smoking. So I think that, again, subconsciously, like, these things.
You absorbed that.
I absorbed that. And many years later, because the first 10 years of my life, I was actually an actress. So there's the performance bit coming in. And I went to drama school. I was always quite entrepreneurial, like, in terms of doing my own thing. I had my own theatre company. I was always trying to make things happen, I suppose. Yeah. And I had a moment where I fell out of love with acting, almost like falling out of love with a person, very almost like it felt like it all happened in a moment. Of course it didn't. It would have been leading up to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I had to do something else. I just didn't know what that was. And then I remembered that something came into me about the tapes, and I saw this course, clinical hypnotherapy. I was like, that sounds amazing. I said, that just sounds unreal. Like, that's, you know, and that's really where it started.
And where was that course? Where did you learn hypnosis?
It was called Irish Hypnosis. It was, clinical hypnosis, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. And as soon as I started it, like, I started to see the power of it for myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when you know, isn't it? Like,
oh, completely. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Because I'd been through a lot of psychotherapy, talk therapy, and I'd been on my own journey. And then hypnotherapy is actually what really, I think, made that huge difference in terms of the neuroplastic change in my brain. In terms of,
Can you describe what neuroplastic change is?
Well, it's experience-led adult possibility to change our brain. So we talk about in childhood the brain is plastic and malleable.
Yeah,
and that's through just by
experience in life.
Experience in life.
Yeah,
as we get older, and I think one of the greatest learnings of our time is that the brain is still malleable and plastic in adulthood.
Yeah, and we didn't know that until kind of recent times, really.
Yeah, it is about 10 years now at this stage, but it's still recent enough still in recent the history though, yeah. of... Yeah, it is. And we know now that we ourselves, like you said, self-hypnosis, it's self-directed neuroplastic change. And that is essentially through repetition, which is where hypnosis is so effective.
Yes.
We can literally change the neural pathways in our brain so that they become default, if you like. So let's say there's a negative habit there in your brain, which is where, you know, the positive habit comes from. It's a habit as much as anything else. There's a negative habit of anxiety. Anxiety is a habit as much as positivity is a habit, right? But when you train your brain to literally start to walk down a different neural pathway, it will automatically, over time, that will start to happen.
Yeah.
But it does require, like in adulthood, it's not just osmosis. We need to take control of it.
Well, you mentioned the positive habit, and that's kind of your USP. Can you explain what is the positive habit? Like, what is it? I mean, like, if you're someone...
I suppose it's the name of... I don't even like the word brand because it sounds kind of too commercial. I suppose it's the name of my... of what I'm about, if you like.
Yeah.
So essentially, it is an umbrella term, if you like, for everything in terms of positive emotions, right? Yeah. Whether it's calmness, confidence, happiness... I feel that when we have a positive, optimistic outlook, that encapsulates it all. But where does that come from? Well, we need to establish that as a habit, as a default state. So that comes through the training. That comes through the practice. And that's another thing I see with clients is that, you know, it's like, you know, you wouldn't expect to have the result. Like if you look at your mental health, you wouldn't expect to be really physically fit without actually going and doing whatever it is, whether, you know, like I practice a lot of yoga. I wouldn't expect to be able to do the kind of yoga I can without actually going, you know, 4 times a week, right?
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
We could all say that. Yeah, that makes sense. The mind is no different. Mm-hmm. It needs that repetition and it needs that training. And that's what I love about this is that it's so possible.
So what is the practice? Like just so people out there can have a tool or a technique to use. If you were to say, here's one positive practice I want you to do every day for the positive habit. Like if you were to just give one thing. I know you have many, right?
Yes, but
just
give them one. It's so funny when people ask me that because I feel, being completely honest, that creates pressure, right? Give me one thing. And I know where you're going and I totally understand it, right? But my concern is that it's feeding into the very problem.
Okay.
Right? If that makes sense. Mm. Everyone's looking for the one thing. Everyone's looking for the quick thing. And anyone who tells you that there is one thing or quick thing isn't being completely honest or frank with you.
Okay, so then let's stack then. Oh, we'll ping pong, right? Let's ping pong.
Ping
right?
pong, okay. Right, we'll ping pong. I like ping pong.
So we can stack them. Well, I just want people listening to have takeaway, right? Okay. That's what I kind of want.
I know.
So I fully agree, right? There's no magic wand. You got to stack, right? You got to stack those positive habits. I do have a question in a moment, but I'll hold my question, right?
Okay.
I would say for me, and it's different for everybody, right? I would say the number one practice is breath work. And I, right now I'm doing breath work like every single morning without fail. I've got it nailed in. It's my discipline. It's my habit. Number one, for anybody who wants to know breath work, look, it's simple. Just find 5 minutes. Either just focus on the breath. That's what meditation is. And I think a nice way for people to reduce their anxiety and to practice the breath work is just inhale and count one on the inhale. And as you exhale slowly through the mouth, count one as well. So one in, one out, two in, two out, three in, three out. And just do that for about 5 minutes and it resets and regulates your autonomic nervous system and so on. I personally favour the Wim Hof method. However, it's slightly more forceful in nature and that's not for everybody. That's what I say. It works for me. But out there, I say breath work first. What's yours? It doesn't have to be your first, but just ping pong.
Give me another.
Heart-focused breathing. Heart-focused breathing. I love it. Go. What's that?
I studied heart math and essentially...
Heart math?
Heart math. Have you heard of it?
What the hell is heart math? No, I like knowing and hearing terms that I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never heard of heart math.
Okay. Well, it's an institute in America that is like, it's really, I don't know how many people are following, but it's huge.
Okay.
And it's scientifically proven that, you know, the heart, which is something I think doesn't get enough mention,
yep,
is so intelligent and has basically the communication goes from the heart to the brain.
Yep.
And that we have a radius outside of us where our heart energy is emulating into, okay, like. And essentially, what we want to do is start to move away from the head, the busy brain,
yeah,
which is a threat detecting system,
yep,
which will always tell you what is wrong and mm-hmm, is trying to protect you, and to move into the heart space. So this technique, heart-focused breathing, is the heart math most, I suppose, basic strategy, which is essentially you close your eyes and you take your hand to your heart and you start to connect in, you bring your gaze down and you start to breathe slowly in and out of the heart. So you're imagining that it is the heart that is breathing.
Okay.
And what happens is that you go into a state of coherence. Okay, so your brain now and your heart are in a state of coherence and your HRV, your heart rate variability, is becoming much smoother.
Okay.
So you can, you know, they have machines where they can see the graphs, and when your heart rate is going like it's jagged, right?
Yeah.
You're out of coherence. So a lot of the work that I do essentially is helping people to move from here,
yeah,
into here, into your heart.
Yeah.
And the heart is the place of wisdom. It's the place of courage. It's the place of clarity.
Yeah.
It's where we operate from a place of love, not fear. You know, it's mm-hmm, where essentially we need to really dwell there so much more than in our heads. And that takes an awareness that it's there. But most people are so cut off from it.
Sorry, what's that technique look like? Like in your head, do you visualize the breath going into the heart? Is that what you do?
Yeah, it's really simple in terms of you visualize that it's actually your heart, almost like as its own pair of lungs, if you
okay,
like. And the heart is breathing in and it's breathing out. And, you know, you can then also enhance that by starting to bring in a feeling of appreciation or to remember a moment from your day where you felt, you know, gratitude, love,
yeah,
your child smiled at you. And you immediately start to feel this warmth and openness and glow mm-hmm, in the heart. And you're now in a much more regulated yeah, state. So, you know, to go back to the ping pong, I'm happy to ping pong, right? I really am. But I think, again, it's important to get the overview, right?
Yeah.
Because there's too many conversations and radio stations. And I've been there so many times.
Yeah.
One thing, Fiona, one thing, mm, right? And from my heart, what I feel is that it's doing it a disservice in terms of essentially we all need, if you know, breath work, meditation, yoga, yes, 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 heart-focused breathing, great, great, great.
Yeah.
What are we talking about? What are we actually really getting mm-hmm, at? We're talking about starting to connect to ourselves. We're starting to connect to nature. And we're starting to slow down. And that's what we need to do.
And I agree. The problem with that is most people out there just will tell you, and you've heard it many times,
yeah,
I don't have time to slow down. I've got kids that need dropping to rugby and Gaelic and hurling. So I got to zip around doing that. I've got my 9 to 5.
Yeah.
I'm already getting up at 6:30 in the morning to get the kids' lunches ready. And then weekends, the kids have been driven around. I'm just saying, if you have kids, and if you don't have kids, maybe you're a professional and you're working 14 hours a day instead of 8 hours a day. What do you say to those people? How do they find
space to slow down? As long as we keep saying that, right, what are we doing? We're perpetuating it,
well,
right?
That's what I'm asking. So how do we get people listening here now to your message? How do we get them to understand that they have to create the time to slow down?
By taking the pressure off, not putting it on.
Yeah.
Not by saying if you do this one thing, you're going to, there is no
right,
one thing.
Yeah.
Can you recall what it's like to be a child running in a field?
Yeah, and I do it still. I'm like the hippie, and I know you are too.
Yeah.
I'm out in the back garden in my bare
yes,
feet. I was in the ice bath 2 days ago, and it's just another one of my habits. Like, I know I kind of promote cold therapy and ice bath. But I've been doing it 15 years. Like, I just didn't pop up on Instagram like a lot of people doing it. I've stopped doing it on Instagram, actually. It broke the algorithm. It still breaks. But I found out I wasn't enjoying it as much while I was posting. So I went, you know, I'm just going back to doing it for myself. But I'm still in the ice bath every day. Nobody knows I'm in there. But 2 days ago, I took a laugh and fit in the ice bath, right? Like a complete laugh and fit.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
And my wife is looking out going, what are the neighbours thinking? Because the neighbours can see into my backyard. Like, and they're like, what are they thinking? Keith, will you shut up? I was like, no, this is brilliant for me. It's so cathartic.
Yeah.
And I'm out there. When you say, can I remember? Yeah, I can remember my dad bringing me up the Cum Shinnan Mountains to the magic hill, as we call it, in Waterford, up the Cumber Mountains. And you just stop the car and the car would roll backwards. But then you get out and you go on a big hike. I can remember those days. But I can remember doing it this week as well.
Yes,
do you know what I mean?
Because exactly.
Like even today, when I leave this, right, I have a million projects on at the moment. Now, I'm talking about like a million projects. I'm thinking today when I go home, I'm going to stick the wellies on, grab the fishing rod and go down to the river for about an hour and a half. I shouldn't. Like in my head, I shouldn't, right? Because in my head, it's like, oh, I got to get this done and I got to get that done. I got to get that posted and I got to get back to that client. And I got. But I'm thinking, do you know what? None of it's worth it if I can't go fishing. Do you know what I mean?
I'm going to say, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this.
Go for it. You can curse. You can do what you want on this.
Bollocks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go fishing is what you mean to say.
Yeah. Like when you saying a million projects, you know, you'll go to your deathbed with a million projects.
This is it. Yeah.
They're never going to be finished. They're never going to get to the place.
Mm.
So when you say I shouldn't, you know yourself, and that's why you're saying it.
I'm going to. Yeah.
If should comes into it, of course you should go fishing.
Yeah.
It's the most important thing to do today.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going fishing today.
Yeah.
That's it.
And that is perspective. That's the perspective that I am actually talking about. And I know it sounds like it's coming from a place of privilege. But again, I'm going to have to go back on that because I don't believe that's true. I'm not any more or less privileged than many, many people.
Yeah.
We have to be accountable to ourselves for the choices that we make.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, again, even this morning I had a client saying, but you see, I can't. And we make excuses for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We tell ourselves all sorts of, I'm going to say,
bullshit. Yeah.
Bollocks. Right?
Yeah.
We tell ourselves these things and it somehow then justifies it. And somehow then we you know, well, you see, I didn't have a choice. We always have a choice. And that's what I really believe in, is trying to empower people to see you do have a choice. I would like to admit that over my career, and my husband, Kieran, always laughs at me. He goes, Fiona, how many people have left their jobs? I go, oh, sweetheart, I don't know. Because of me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Not that I tell anyone, leave your job.
Yeah.
But once you start working with someone and once you start connecting them into their own heart and what's true for them, and you remove fear. I've had people going off doing all sorts of amazing things.
Yeah, and so have I want to pick up on that because like, it's important.
I think that when you, and this is going back to my summer in Crete and feeling so wealthy and rich in terms of nature and the abundance of nature. When you spend time in nature, you realize that you have everything.
Mm-hmm.
That you really don't, we don't need very much at all.
Yeah.
It's all just a big kind of charade.
It's an
illusion that we're conditioned into believing. And that's why I'm talking about the Emperor's New Clothes. You see it like, you know, my friends are saying to me, Fiona, you're stoned.
I was going to say, do you think people, because they say it about me. My wife says it about me. Now, my wife knows I'm cuckoo and a bit mad, but she's like, not my wife, but other people are just like, your man's just like
what
crazy.
What planet are you on? Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we're all crazy on some level. But yeah, I'm interested in what you just said there, that your friends are like, you're just stoned.
Well,
you're off your head there. Like, you're not living reality is what they say.
You're not
right?
living in the real world. Yeah. And
what's your pushback on that?
Well, I would say that, to be honest, I think that I'm actually living in the only world that's worth living in. It's like that story I'm sure you've heard of the... it's a fisherman. He could be, you know, it's like a Zen Japan or somewhere. And he's sitting there on the side of the pier and the American businessman comes up and he's, you know, it's like midday and he's just had his sandwich and he's lying back and the sun is on his face. And the American businessman comes up to him and he says, hey, howdy, you know, how many fish you catch today?
Yeah.
And the guy goes, well, I caught enough for myself and my family and I even sold a few. And he said, wow, great, great. And he said, that's your ship out there? And he says, yes, that's my boat. Yes, yeah. You know what you could do? You could get 6 boats. You could have X, Y, you could have all these people working for you, and you could sell, you know, 20 times, 30 times the amount of fish.
Yeah.
And guess what? Then you could just sit back, watch every, the world go by. And the guy just looks and goes, I'm doing that already.
There you go. Yeah.
Why would I put myself through that?
Yeah.
And I think that's where so many of us are lost because we feel like we have to go and get all those boats, whereas we don't need them.
And tell me about your process. And what I mean by that is your professional process. Like, do you meet people online or do you meet them in person or a mixture of both? Or what way does that work?
For years, I saw people just in person. I remember being on an American podcast and the guy said to me, do you see people on, again, American? I said, God, no. I said, I wouldn't do that. That wouldn't work. I said, it just wouldn't be effective. And of course, COVID came along and, you know, all my work went online. And so I do see clients online. It is effective. I'm amazed. I believe that even through my online courses, et cetera, you can reach and help people, which I think it's wonderful.
Like,
I never would have actually believed it myself that you can have that kind of impact.
Yeah.
But you can. And just recently, I'm actually going to go back. I'm starting tomorrow with a one-day clinic in town because I actually want to be in a room again with people. I sort of started to miss that a little bit.
Okay.
You know, so when I can, I will. But it's like you know, it's only it's a part of my work because I do so many other things as well.
Well, tell us about those other things. What else does Fiona Brennan do? Right.
Oh,
so we know
that
there's one-to-one. Obviously people can find these on your website. So what is the website? Just because I think it's important.
Yeah.
I don't think there's enough good clinical hypnotherapists out there. So it's important if you're doing one day a week or a month in town, where is that or where they can find out about it at least?
It's going to be in Dublin too, and thepositivehabit.com is where you can find out more. But essentially, so what happened is with my one-to-one, I started to see how effective it was. I started to see the impact I was having.
The results,
and I was like, wow, kind of surprising myself back whatever it is now, 10 years, 12 years ago. So I wanted to emulate that. So I set up an online course called The Positive Habit. And that's where it started in terms of branching out.
Yeah.
Then that course was a book, which was actually different content, but had the same title, The Positive Habit. And that was my first book back in 2019.
Yeah.
So I'm a writer 3 times. I love writing. I've got a new idea for a book in my mind that's already starting to form. It's a creative process that just kind of falls in and you know, it can't be forced. So I'm very excited about that. I then do a lot of retreats where I would essentially, like, you know, meditation, yoga, really bringing people together. I believe in the power of the group. I think that a lot of healing and transformation comes from realizing that you're not alone. So I love doing retreats here in Ireland and in Crete as well. And
what's the connection with Crete? I'm interested. Like,
well, I mentioned earlier. Yeah, I know. I lived on Paros when I was a child. So Paros is another island.
Okay, so
smaller.
Your parents had a place over there, or whatever, when you were young.
We went there in the 70s.
Okay,
like pure.
It's a very unusual thing to do. Were both your parents Irish?
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you're over.
My parents are incredible. Like, honestly, talk about living a life that's true to you. They have instilled that in me.
Yeah.
You know, they left. It was like 70. How old am I? 77, right?
Okay.
Recession in Ireland. They both had teaching jobs.
Yeah.
They gave them up. Everyone said, what are you doing? You're crazy. It's in a recession. We're going to live in Greece.
Yeah.
They rented out our house. So they had an income. Very, you know, clever. And we lived this. Everything we're talking about. My dad went off fishing, was gone for weeks on end. My mom was weaving. You know, it was a kind of very bohemian childhood. And it was pure, again, just amazing for me to be there in that kind of environment, so close to nature every day in the sea, the sand, the freedom.
Yeah.
So that's in me. And that's my soul calling me. I have to be. You know, summer for me is being in Greece.
Yeah.
It's just, there's no other way around it. So essentially, I've spent so many years going back and forth and just back a few years ago now, myself and Ciarán fell in love with Crete. And I suppose it's our little piece of paradise, if you like. And it's
and Ciarán, your husband's in your Instagram videos very often. I can see you rope him in. Does he love that, or does he cringe when you pull him in?
he actually kind of, it's funny, he does kind of like it. Like, you know, he's very humble. He's one of the few people I've ever met that genuinely has no ego.
Right.
Very rare.
It is rare. I mean, we all say we don't have egos, but we all have egos.
No, but he, yeah, I have an ego. I mean, I know, I'm very well aware of it. But Ciarán is quite exceptional in the sense that he's really at ease with himself.
Yeah.
You know, we have a little kind of, I love this little car, like a little Fiat, you know, green thing. Ciarán will drive that around without blinking
an
eyelid.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't give a hoot. Mm. So he left his job 4 years ago to work full time together.
Yeah.
So we worked together and, you know, a lot of people go, oh my God, how do you not kill each other? Mm. And of course we have had our moments.
Yeah.
But essentially, and I think you work with Mairead a bit as well.
I do. Mairead's my wife. And I work with Mairead. And look, it works well. But again, you have your moments. But overall, it's fine. Like, you know.
Overall, I think it's more than fine. I think it's amazing because it's like, where and how and when will you ever find someone who's so invested?
Well, this is it. They're invested in you and your business and success.
Yeah. So he's coming out more into the forefront, if you like. He started doing sound baths. He's an amazing meditation teacher.
Okay.
You know, so he has a lot to offer. Like,
yeah.
He has a lot of wisdom and presence. And so we're creating this life. And I think that's the thing, is having the courage to do that, you know, because people often will say, oh, I'll do that when I retire. I'll wait.
Yeah.
You know, but I won't buy the house now. You know, we have a son, we have a dog, we have responsibilities.
Yeah.
But I feel that's a mistake. Don't wait to live your life. You know, go fishing, go to Crete. Do what is actually in your own heart. And that, it does take courage. There's no two ways about it. It's not like it all comes easily. There's sacrifices that are made, and when I say sacrifices, I mean you will get backlash because people don't necessarily want you going off the track.
Yeah.
That's not what you should be doing at this stage in your life. You should be doing X, Y, or Z. Why are you leaving a pensionable job? You know, Ciarán was in civil service with a good job. And, I'm not, yeah. What, like, it's just, it's madness.
If not now, then when, I suppose, is the question, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people know this, right? It's not necessarily groundbreaking, but how many people actually live it?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm always trying to get to help people is to be committed to what's really true in your own heart, in your own desires, and to remove the fear. And when you remove the fear, you're free.
Yeah, and listen, I haven't even looked at a note since we've chatted here. I've got notes in front of me and I haven't even looked at any of these notes.
That's a good sign, Keith.
To wrap it up, though, I have a fun question, right?
Okay.
It's just an interesting question more than a fun question. What's the most profound change that you can remember in your whole career when somebody came into you and you just went, I remember that one, without naming the person, obviously. I just remember that one.
Funnily, years and years ago, a young guy came to me about the fear of football. You had a fear of actually playing football.
I'd believe it because I've had so many I've had so many of those, like fear of vegetables, fear of carrots, fear of birds, fear of balloons. Like I've had fear of water was another one, but not swimming. Fear of washing his face. So I get it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So this guy, fear of football.
He had fear of playing football. Yeah.
I laugh. I'm laughing, but it wasn't laughable for him, I bet.
No, not at all. Yeah. No, of course not. And essentially what we explored was that when he was younger, I think he was about 20 when he came to me, but when he was 15, he'd been very good at football and he'd thought that he was going to go on, as many young lads do. And, you know, and I say, absolutely dream big, but it didn't happen for him.
Yeah.
So he thought that, you know, and since then he found that his confidence, he was so self-conscious that he couldn't even go out and knock the ball around with his friends out on the estate or whatever. It was just too much. So we worked through that and And then he was like, oh yeah, it's grand. He'd put in so much pressure on him.
Yeah.
So that's just one that
But it's lovely though to get those results. Like
yeah.
I think sometimes we don't look back enough. And what I mean by that is my own mentor, Tony Sadar, he's 83. Mm. I said it to him one time. I was like, Tony, have you ever thought about the fact over 63 years of being professionally a hypnotherapist that you've probably saved thousands of lives between everything from stopping smoking and people who have been suicidal have gone to him. And I really pushed that hard onto him because I was like, you need to take a moment to appreciate it. And I would say the same to you. Like, you know, we need to look back at some of those moments and go, wow, actually I profoundly helped somebody's and potentially saved a life. I'm not talking about in those instances, but in an overall capacity.
Yeah.
I'm going to spring something on you real quick, just to wrap it up completely.
Yeah.
a book that either you've read recently that you really enjoyed or just a book that changed your life. Is there one?
Yes. One that I read at the big, sort of, again, going back 10, 12 years was The 7 Spiritual Laws of Success, Deepak Chopra.
Okay, yeah.
Love it. My favourite law in that is the law of least effort. And that, again, brings us to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea that nature doesn't try to grow. Grass grows. It doesn't force itself. Look at autumn now, the leaves are falling. They're not, you know, it's just a natural sort of development and shift and change. And I feel that that's something we need to embody is that law of least effort. It's not no effort.
Yeah. No, I get
which
it,
I think is quite,
I love that. Yeah.
I love embodying that as much as I can. And that's where the magic happens.
Well, I must pick up that book because the last time I tried to read a Deepak Chopra book, I think it was... Was it synchronicity?
Yes,
it was above my pay grade. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't make head or tail of it. So hopefully that one's an easier read of Deepak's.
It is.
You know?
Yeah, it's very straightforward.
But the other one was just like way above my pay grade. So listen, thank you so much for joining us on Open Mind. Fiona has some upcoming public speaking workshops. Tell us about those real quick.
Yeah, so that's another area I love. They're starting next week, actually. It's an area that you see really good transformation in terms of someone who's so nervous going in to speak, to do anything, and then helping them to find that confidence. But really, it's back to the heart. Like I do a lot of work of if you're communicating from your heart, you don't need to worry about, you know, what you're, it's going to flow.
And do you use hypnosis in these sessions, these public speaking sessions?
Yes, I would.
Okay, brilliant. And these are called Learn to Face the Crowd with Confidence. It's a 4-week interactive online training course, so you can access this anywhere you are in the world listening to this now.
Yeah.
Check out thepositivehabit.com for all the information. Thank you so much, Fiona.
Thank you, Keith.
And keep doing your thing, as they say. Thank you so much.
I will. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow, rate and share wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show and it means the world to us. Thanks for listening.